Yeah, and so in case listeners on the internet want to hear your questions about the ARC that Ken Ham, I believe it was, built in Kentucky. Yeah, and the plausibility or not of that. Yeah, so definitely you can reconstruct the number of cubits based upon the biblical narrative. The ARC story is very ancient. So the Babylonians have one. It's a different size ARC, it's a different shape. But it's interesting that there are a lot of flood narratives with an ARC. And we can point to scientific events that might have launched that tradition, like the Black Sea flooding. So you can go back to, there may have been, well, a cultural memory of something historical there, lo and behold, right? But that it covered the whole world, there's zero evidence. All the evidence is against it. That you could fit all the millions and really billions of species in it is physically impossible. So when you talk to, like, sort of God-loving Protestant brethren who are creationists, they'll kind of present different ways, obviously, to account for it. One time at a talk, I got someone who was claiming that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time. If you date the Bible based upon that, it's about 6,000 years old, the world. Which, you know, if we subscribe to any modern scientific measurements, it's kind of hard to buy that. So then people can kind of divide that off. Well, this part was scientific, this is not. I kind of respect the literalist movement when they just go, look, it's all video camera. Boom. The problem is, from the Catholic standpoint, is that contradicts everything we know from reason. But another neat side of that is the church is never going to say, thou must believe this about the ark or that about the ark historically. It's interesting that we'll make those claims with the resurrection and whatnot, right? But with the ark, we don't. But when you see the parallel between Noah, and Utnapishtim, the Babylonian figure of the Nemeh Elish or of Gilgamesh, it's pretty clear the story is predating it. So what you see in Jewish narrative when you do the comparative religions and you study ancient Jewish lit is they would take an ancient tradition and they would develop the story midrashically. They'd retell it and develop it. So it's not a video camera history in that way, but like the Catechism says, real events in figurative language. The real area for the playground of Chesterton is how much of that is figurative and how much is not. And so there's a lot of beautiful room for play on that one. Yeah, and that is like, amen, everything towards Christ. It's a good example of how Protestant and Catholic brethren, we should be able to get along on the fundamentals. Most Catholics will not agree with that interpretation, right? But insofar as I think of the Museum of the Bible in DC I've been to, and that's had some controversy how they obtain their documents, but we're all on the same team, especially in today's culture. One of my favorite lines from Benedict, unrelated to this directly, is the greatest argument for the faith, the greatest apologia, is the beauty in the saints the church has produced. It's that witness that we need. And Augustine would say, we should have unity in essentials. We should have liberty in non-essentials, but in all things, charity. So when I engage someone who takes that story as if it were pure history, you know, as long as we're living as brothers, I'm happy with that. You know, I just don't want to cause obstacles to, you know, Aquinas says unbelievers. The real problem is young people who leave the faith because of the perceived incompatibility. And I love John Paul and Benedict's example of how it need not be so. But then the field of theology comes in as distinct from catechesis that go together to really probe that and try to give the deep dive into why might God have done it this way and what does it really mean? Thank you. Yeah. So this is great. Pius XII in the year 1950 kind of famously issued a document called Humani Generis. And this is when the church first opened the door to evolution. And he says, look, you've got to hold to original sin. And what that looked like is a matter of debate, frankly. But original sin essentially states, as Pope Benedict said in a catechesis in Rome, you can't save yourself. You need the grace of Christ. And that began with the very first member or members of the human race. So before that, though, the church, he Pius leaves it open. And the last three, four popes, I guess, John the 23rd didn't really talk about it. John Paul I was pope for a month. Paul VI didn't talk about it, to my knowledge. And you have the last few popes try to expand upon that. So they are aware, especially Benedict, that Homo sapiens has been around for hundreds of thousands of years. And then what it looked like precisely, we have a pretty good narrative, but there's options. So this is a scholarly article, but one of my friends is named Father Nicholas Lombardo. He's a Dominican at Catholic University of America. And he sits out and presents four narratives that have begun with one person, Adam, and spread humanity from there to two people, have those first mutations that made possible the infusion of the soul, or was it a population? There really are different options there, but what we know pretty surely now is that it's a lot older than previously thought. It's not gonna get revised younger, it's gonna get revised older, if anything. So on the earlier end, 150,000 years, if art and burial of the dead mean humanity, which they probably do, we're already human by then. And then you can get into debate. Homo erectus seems to have had fire 2 million years ago. And I love what Pope Benedict says. We're never going to be able to definitively excavate the first human historically with a shovel. So it'll be opaque to us. Was it 200,000 years ago or 2 million? Until we can ask him in heaven. But the church leaves, as Pius says, room for research on that. And I've been very impressed the past several years, especially. I've been working on this for 15 or 20 years and finally decided to write a book on it a few years ago. But there's a lot of good Catholic thinking on this right now. A book I recommend, it's very easy read. It's some Dominicans collaborated on it. Father Nicanor Ostriaco is a biologist and a priest, and it's called Thomistic Evolution. It's not as in-depth as mine, but it's like a great primer, and they're not the only ones who've done this good work. And so he'll say some similar things to that in there. That one's called Thomistic Evolution. They have a website too. It's basically the website in book form, but I kind of prefer the book so I can write in it. Another one I put up on this list, guys, if I may, I'm a video person. I have one eye that works. My friend Chris Baglow, he heads Notre Dame's Faith and Science Initiative, and he has a Word on Fire course, which is really good. And he has a book that goes with it, which I put up there. And then the Society of Catholic Scientists website is very good as well, just resources. But when I talk to people, I'm like, yeah, buy my book. But frankly, as an entry point, it's hard to go wrong with those or that video series. Yeah. No, I totally know because I'm going through it, right? I was teaching some monks on Zoom in Ireland on Saturday, and my son asked me one of these questions at 7 a.m. when I'm trying to get ready to go to class. I'm like, oh boy. So yeah, what we do with our kids is, well, we do science. I mean, they have an earth science class and we go and we see the actual things. We have a great natural history museum at the University of Kansas, and we just introduce them. And it comes up naturally. But with the Bible, we pretty much do the narrative as the narrative says with the kids and let them ask any questions. I don't go out of my way to say, by the way, that's not historical. You know, I don't do that. But they're smart enough, they eventually raise the question. And at least so far, I mean, our oldest is only about 13, so we don't have old kids. But from teaching a bunch of college kids, that seems to go well. What doesn't go well is I'll have a student in class and they'll be like, I had to unlearn everything I learned in homeschool. We homeschool, incidentally, because they use this Protestant textbook, which came out swinging against all the science. But like the other day, one of the kids was like, and yeah, the ark had all the animals. I'm like, oh, no. But I didn't say it because it's physically impossible that it had all the animals in it. But the more important thing, as I teach in my Pentateuch class, is to get the narrative of salvation history. So the actual history of Israel and the theological truths that come out of this. And I just love, it's like that art of teaching your kids of prudentially figuring out when and where to say what. That's my two cents. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good question. The question about the soul and when it arose. So the church is not teaching when the first one arose. That's the competence of science, as John Paul would say. But that the first human had something unique compared to everything else is dogma, right? And so you'll have, as Aquinas says, animals have a share in rationality. Even my cat, Aquinas says it has a certain ability to reason. It can like rub your leg trying to get you to do something, and it can go in and out and in and out of the door trying to do something or other, right? Octopi, pretty smart, right? So, but none of them have the ability to truly express a gift of self and love and to know the truth and contemplate it and worship God. So those are the things that Pope Benedict would say you can't excavate with a shovel. Now, the word soul, I just want to say a few moments about that too. So traditionally in the Middle Ages, you'd study philosophy before theology, and that's what I did. The church largely looks at things after the manner of Aristotle when it comes to the soul. So the soul, anima in Latin, is that which animates, that which gives life. Every living thing has a soul, as the way we see it in Catholicism. Even the cat has a soul. And what you mean specifically, I think, is the spiritual soul, that which is not bound to the matter strictly. And that is what the church, like Pius XII says, is infused directly by God. The Pius says the body can evolve, but there's something unique that God does to infuse the soul. Funny enough, though, even infusion of soul is metaphorical language, because infusion means to pour into in Latin. But we know the soul is not like a ghost that floats in and out of you. But it's interesting when you talk about these most important things that are really, the simpler they are, the harder to talk about it is. And you have to resort to images and to metaphors, like the Trinity, you know, Patrick with the shamrock. Technically, that's heretical, the shamrock. We can talk about that afterwards. But you've got to be able to use images to convey it. So the short answer, though, is the dating of it, the church doesn't have a teaching on. Yeah. Well, millions were alive. So, yeah, but no, I wrote a book on that one, too, called Dark Passages of the Bible. I actually don't recommend it for the first introduction to the topic. It's like seriously deep theology. But I'm going to say a few things about it, but I have a couple sources I like to recommend. I've given a couple lectures for the Thomistic Institute. I gave a couple on that. I'm pretty happy with it. You could listen to that. Another one is Word on Fire. This is a good book for a lot of things. We did a book recently called The New Apologetics, this green book. And we have about 5-page essays on a lot of different topics. There's one on defending the church, on gender, and on all kinds of stuff. So what I do in there is I present different options. But so, for example, Aquinas would say of those passages that God doesn't owe anybody life, so he can kill whoever he wants. It's a lot more nuanced than that. Another more nuanced text of Aquinas says, by God's decree, people die every day. In other words, God allows our death. Yeah, there's the original sin part, but also that's also for our sanctification and to make us, as John Paul II says, realize the fleetingness of life and to reform our souls. Another interpretation, I like this interpretation, is the divine pedagogy, that back in that day, Joshua, Moses, 1500 BC, give or take, you wiped out all your enemies, harem warfare. The law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was actually progress. It was limiting violence. And when Abraham was stopped from killing his kid, that was normal practice. There's an advance. But it is the best that people could grasp at the time. But now in light of Christ, if you heard God say, go kill your neighbor, pagan's kids, please don't listen, right? Because we know in light of Christ, that's not his will. The other interpretation, this sounds like the most dicey at first, is a lot of the church fathers don't read it historically. They read some of those passages symbolically. And interestingly enough, on some of those, not all of them, but the problem can be addressed by the fact that the 150,000 Assyrians, for example, but the cities of Jericho and Ai that were wiped out, the archaeologists say and publish, and there's a Vatican document on this even, that the cities weren't populated at the time, which suggests that it was meant all along to be symbolic. What would it symbolize? There comes in theology. Root out everything that's not of Yahweh in your lives, especially during Babylonian exile, living amongst the pagans. You got to be willing to exterminate the evil. So Saint Benedict, not Pope Benedict, says of a different text, Psalm 137, where the psalmist rejoices in the bashing of Babylonian baby heads. He says, really what that means is bash your sins while they're still small. Because we all know, sadly, you don't say no to the sin, what's it do? Snowballs, right? And there's the perennial truth of the text. Now, as C.S. Lewis points out, the guy who wrote the psalm, David or not, he also wanted to kill his enemy's kids. And so we've moved towards Christ, but he couldn't teach them all that immediately. He took hundreds of years to get the people. But what's beautiful about the church fathers is when you read the Bible in light of both the ancients and the moderns, the church fathers are always concerned, how does this apply to my life? What's it mean about Christ? And even those really dark texts, like exterminating them, they see spiritual value in it.